All right, this afternoon we're starting off with a topic I mentioned earlier, and that was an update on proposed standards and concept releases. There's the proposed standards on risk assessment that I mentioned a number of times, and two concept releases, one on the use of confirmations and one of signing the audit report. And we'd like to give you an update. The comment periods are closed, but we'd like to give you an update on the comments we have received and then open it up for any commentary that you might have. The first item we're going to discuss is the proposed standard on risk assessment, and to my left, Keith Wilson will lead that discussion.
Thank you, Marty. Approximately a year ago at this time, the board issued for comment, as Marty mentioned earlier, a suite of seven proposed auditing standards and related conforming amendments regarding the auditor's responsibilities for assessing and responding to risk in an audit. The comment period closed in February, and we received 33 comment letters. The demographics, as you see on the slide, 18 or roughly 54% of those came from auditing firms and associations of accountants. The next group of commenters were academics and groups of academics, about 12%, and then there was roughly a mixture among issuers, business groups, internal auditors, an investor representative, and some other standard setters and individuals. Now, what I want to try and do for these next couple of slides is talk about just some of the general themes that came through in the comment letter process. And to do that and help set the stage for that, I'd like to back up and give you just a few minutes of background. When this proposal was issued, the board outlined and identified a list of objectives that they wanted to try and accomplish through this project. The first one of those was to update the board's standards relating to risk assessment to, in light of the changes and the audit methodologies that are risk-based that have been implemented and are prevalent in practice. The second one is to further the integration of the standards relating to risk assessment with the standard for the audit of internal control over financial reporting, AS number 5. And the third was to try to incorporate into these standards the general principles for identifying, assessing, and responding to the risk of material misstatement due to fraud that have existed in the board's interim standard on fraud, but to make the fraud responsibilities a more central part of the risk assessment process. And as part of the development process for these standards, the board did look carefully at the related risk assessment standards of the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board, particularly looking at the objectives and the requirements of those standards and trying to determine whether they were appropriate for audits of issuers, which is our area of responsibility. So, as you can see now from this slide, we received a lot of comments in each of those areas. First of all, there was general support. Almost everyone who commented in a comprehensive way, at least, supported the idea of updating these standards to speak more directly to the risk-based audit. There was also pretty broad support for enhancing the integration of these risk assessment standards with the standard for internal control over financial reporting. And in fact, we received a number of comments that would seek to improve that integration. For example, trying to move more of the risk assessment requirements into these standards out of auditing standard number 5. When it comes to the fraud-related aspects, the views were a bit mixed. We had 15 people specifically comment on the topic of integrating these standards more closely with fraud, and 8 of the 15 were supportive of the board's approach. There were 4 who were not as supportive of the board's approach or expressed some concerns about it, and then the remaining 3 were somewhat neutral or ambivalent about it. An example of that would be, yes, we could see doing that, but our methodology already integrates the consideration of fraud into our core methodology, so we don't think it would have any effect on practice one way or the other. So more of a neutral stance with respect to that. Then in terms of perhaps more technical or specific comments, we received a number of comments related to the extent and nature of the requirements in the standards. Comments such as there were a comparison of these standards to the IAASB standards or the ASB standards, and they may observe that our proposal had more requirements than the than a comparable IAASB standard. There were also cases where they commented on the specific language of requirement, for example, saying that we really needed to explicitly build into the language of a requirement the qualified based on the auditor's use of professional judgment. There were a host of other comments related to what I'll call the use of terms to describe the auditor's responsibilities. And here we're actually talking about verbs. So where we may have a requirement for the auditor to evaluate or assess a matter, we'd receive some comments that to use a different choice of words, such as the auditor should consider a given matter. So and usually those were, again, in comparison to either the board's interim standard or the related standards of the IAASB or ASB. We received a number of comments about the organization and style of these standards. These proposed standards had a slightly different format from some of the previously issued standards of the board. For example, there was a specific section that outlined the objective of each of these proposed standards. And the commenters were supportive of having an objective in each standard, certainly. They did indicate some, not necessarily reservations about the format we used, but basically came down to you need to develop a standard template for your standards, a standard style, and just implement that and follow it from now on. So we received a fair number of comments related to that. And then finally, there were a series of comments about the effective date of the standards. We hadn't specifically mentioned or proposed an effective date for the standards, but we received a number of comments. A lot of them were related to guidelines on how the board should determine its effective date for the standards, along the lines of please allow us enough time to change our methodologies and to be able to have enough time to train the staff and those kinds of things. And an important point that was also made by a number of those commenters was that the board should propose a specific effective date and seek comment on that prior to actually adopting the standards. So those are some of the most common comments that we received on the standards. Be interested in any reactions. We'll open this up for discussion, and whether you have comments about these, the standards themselves, maybe views that support some of the comments we received, or other views. Does anyone have a reaction to the idea of the approach for incorporating the general responsibilities for fraud into these standards? Any comments one way or the other on that topic?
Keith, I was interested in that point, of course, and I was wondering if others might be, as you said, there were kind of mixed views on whether or not to embed fraud throughout the planning and throughout the risk assessment process and throughout the audit, but there were some who view that as not a good idea, not neutral, but some were negative on that. Could you expand more on ones who were negative on that?
I guess the way I would characterize the most of those concerns were around the lines of they tended to prefer having a separate standard that was focused specifically on fraud. They thought it was helpful to have all of the auditor's responsibilities related to fraud summarized in one place, and preferred that to the approach of incorporating the key aspects into the core standards for risk assessment.
Keith, if I might ask, it's been some time since I've read these, and so when you ask for, do we have any comments, I wasn't really expecting it. What's the timetable now? Could we give you any comments by email on the specific standards, or what's doable here? Because I feel like I'm maybe not quite as prepared as I could have been.
Well, actually, I think the comment period is closed, and we're in the process now of revising the proposed standards and putting them before the board. I think I indicated earlier that our target was to issue proposed standards in re-proposed these standards in December is our target. We wanted to present today, generally in keeping with the theme of updating the SAG in terms of developments, what was the nature of the comments we received. And as long as we were doing that, we just thought we would take the opportunity today, if anybody wanted to react to the comments we received or had something else to say, to do that. But other than that, I'd say that essentially the comment period is closed. So thank you.
Damon Silvers?
I mean, I spoke earlier today about the fraud standard, which I guess some of the commenters felt was a better place to address these issues than in the sort of in risk assessment and sort of throughout the standard, the body of auditing standards. I mean, I think the board ought to be wary of a catch-22 here, right? I mean, there's been plenty of instances in Washington of people who don't want to do anything always pointing you somewhere else. Like wherever you are, wherever you're actually acting, they will, oh, no, that's not the right place to act. Go over here. When you get over there, then they're, oh, no, that's not the right place to act. Come back here. Right. The board should be wary of that kind of thing. My own view is that I think you need to do both. I think that there needs to be a clear, overarching set of obligations on auditors in relation to fraud. And then I think there needs to be an understanding, and then that basic framework needs to be embedded, right, in areas such as risk assessment, where it's clearly, I think, part of what the investing public thinks is happening here, is that auditors are keeping an eye out for circumstances that lend them, that would appear to increase the probability that fraud may be occurring. I also see fraud as a continuum, as one end of a continuum of potential problems with a financial statement, and that in setting standards for risk assessment, I'm not sure how you would. I think you have to give guidance and more than guidance for looking for mistakes. Looking for conduct, which I think is somewhere, I'm not sure the term of art, but there is something between a mistake and a fraud, right? That, to me, it's a little bit more intentional than a mistake. But for the insistence of an auditor that the principles of financial accounting have to be complied with, would go forward, but it's not somebody forgetting how to add. I don't see how you give the guide. I don't see how you set a set of standards around risk assessment taking into account that range of human behavior and not embody in it some attitude toward toward assessing the risk of fraud. And so, like I said, I think both is the right answer.
Okay. Thank you. Just before we move on to Gary, let me just mention that we, as a point of clarification, we are intending that there continue to be a separate standard related to fraud. But we do feel like there's some important principles that need to be captured in there too. So
I was suggesting that the overall fraud standard needs to be strengthened, right? At the same time as you're undertaking this exercise.
Right.
So I'm sort of the opposite of the person who says do nothing. You know, I do everything.
All right. Very good. Gary Cabaret.
Yeah. Thanks. Actually, I think Damon said a lot of what I was going to say. Is I think, Marty, in your opening comments, you had said these standards, these seven things, they're going to become foundational audit standards as opposed to tactical. And if they're foundational, I think the possible existence of fraud or the auditor's inspection for it is one of the central things auditors do work on. And I think it should be in there. I think, again, maybe you want a separate fraud standard of how to deploy, you know, audit procedures, but I would think in the risk standards you'd want to come up with an answer to questions: is fraud a primary or secondary audit, you know, objective? And do you automatically assume fraud, or is it only when evidence of possible fraud emerges? And are you looking for positive or negative evidence? I think that should be in the risk standard. And again, maybe in different standards, maybe you've got, you know, different, you know, goals for them. Then in a separate fraud standard, okay, if I have to assume fraud exists as a primary audit objective, how do I actually go about doing that? What is the standards of detailed audit performance? I think if these are truly foundational standards, these seven, I don't know how fraud can't be inside of it.
Thank you. Dean Coleman?
Yeah, Damon, I know you're a lawyer and not an auditor, and I'm an auditor, and I do this for a living. Do you mind, I just try and understand, make sure I fully understand what you're saying, and can you just, perhaps for me, if you start at a forensic audit, right, and you work your way along the continuum, what the vision you're articulating that either came from Treasury or where you want to go, I'm just trying to understand where you want to go, where do you put yourself along that continuum so I understand when... You know, because when you're saying both a separate standard and embedding it on the standards, and we're going to talk about this afternoon because it's certainly in some of the other materials that we got, I'm just trying to understand the vision of where you're, what you're articulating. Could you do that along the continuum?
Well, I mean, I'm like Galen in that I don't actually have the text of the fraud standard in front of me, but I think it's a very fair question. Because I think we definitely should not be expecting that every audit is a forensic audit. I think there's a risk of that there's a risk of that in this way of thinking.
Right, because that's what I hear when you're articulating it. That's what I kind of hear you saying.
Yeah,
that's why I'm looking for the clarification.
Right, and that's absolutely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I think that we need to move the dial a bit. On the overall audit standard, so that there is an overall obligation on the auditor to be. I'm sorry, the IT guys tell me that's wrong with my mic. That we need to move the overall dial on the audit standard to create. Oh, it's my BlackBerry. Put it in my pocket. See, I just got one. I just gave in and got one of these things, and I don't know, you know,
they're evil.
That's what Sam and I have been discussing, the various pernicious qualities of BlackBerries, both recognizing that neither of us would, you know, part with it any more than we'd part with our right arms. I think this is why the sort of the risk assessment area is one where it's particularly good, would be a particularly good idea to have an integrated approach that then embodied this approach elsewhere. So I think that they need to move the dial a little bit in terms of auditors having some obligation some greater obligation than is currently embodied in the current fraud standard to act in contexts where there's essentially a reasonable suspicion. And that then I think you then need to embody that in areas such as this, that approach in areas such as this. I don't think that we can create, I mean, this was a subject of some extensive discussion in the Treasury Committee. Some people, and I think Lynn may feel that my basic approach is not tough enough, and unfortunately he's not here at the moment, maybe he'll chime in later. Some people felt that we ought to be moving very much toward a kind of absolute liability standard. Right? You don't find fraud, it's the auditor's fault. That is not my view. I think that there are, but it's also not my view that fraud is something unrelated to the audit, and looking for fraud is something unrelated to the audit. That doesn't parse with what I think the public's expectation is of the auditing profession.
Greg Jonas?
I perceive a disconnect in something, and it's probably just me, so a little education would help me. But my understanding is that we proposed substantive, foundational thinking with these seven standards, that it was well thought out, that the comment letters have come back. I'm interpreting your comments to be generally supportive, and yet you plan to repropose as a next step, suggesting to me that you see certain major areas that are broken to the point that you have new thinking that you want to put in place and expose that for public comment. Could you elaborate for me on what you think about your initial proposal that is in a major way broken that would cause you to want to repropose? Because I'm not hearing that in our comments, and that's the disconnect that I perceive.
I'll start on that, and Keith can follow on. I think because of the fact that these are so important in terms of being foundational standards, we want to make sure that we have it absolutely right. So I think it's not so much that what we proposed, we got back comments that indicated there were significant deficiencies in it. We did get back good comments, and in some places we've made changes in response to those comments. In some places, we decided not to make changes. But because they, as I said, we think they're important enough and so important to the foundation of the entire audit, the risk assessment process, planning the audit, considering the impacts of materiality and judgments, that we want to put it out one more time. Let everybody see how we've amended the proposals, and then just get comments back and then go final.
So Marty, help me out with a little percentage. If you know, 0% would be a re-exposure of exactly what you had before, and 100% would be I'm going to change everything I proposed before, where are you on that continuum, would you guess, roughly? A 10% course correction?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't know that I've really thought of it in terms of a specific percentage. Let me try and say that some of the things that we're contemplating now and that we're looking at doing with these standards tend to be more in the areas of refinements, not major structural changes, if that helps in terms of the way we're looking at the standards.
That's an 11% comment.
Okay. You're much more comfortable with percentages than I am.
Given that Keith wasn't willing to throw out a percentage, I do think it's closer to the 11% than it is to the 100, though. But again, notwithstanding that, given their importance, we feel let's repropose them and get one more set of comments and then go final. Thank you.
Joe Carcello?
Wanted to talk a little bit about the fraud question, Marty. And first of all, I agree with Damon. First of all, I think an absolute liability standard would be a big mistake. Someone who's spent a lot of my professional career studying fraud, a lot of these frauds are very elaborate. And I don't know if the right answer is to embed the fraud guidance throughout all the standards or keep it separate. So I'm not going to really, I don't have a strong opinion on that. But I did want to, as some of you in the room know, that we are working, me and three other people, are working with COSO to update the study on fraud that we did in 1999. And although we're not done, we do have some preliminary information that I think is important. First of all, fraud continues to be a big problem. There's well over 300 fraud companies between 1998 and 2007. There's well over 1,000 enforcement releases related to those 300 fraud companies. In the 99 study that we did for COSO, the size of the companies was very, very small. And so someone could say, well, this is only a problem of very tiny companies. Although, by and large, fraud companies do tend to be smaller. The size of the companies has increased by over a factor of 6. That's not due to inflation, guys. You can do the math. The stock price decline is approximately 20% at the first disclosure, not necessarily a fraud, the first disclosure that there may be an accounting problem. And bankruptcy, delisting, material asset sales, and other adverse consequences to the firm and their shareholders is significantly more likely than a matched sample of no-fraud companies. So this is just, you know, tidbits from my memory, and we're still doing a lot of additional work. But the reason I mention this is just for the board to understand, for the SEC representatives to understand, since this study comes from your enforcement actions, that this continues to be a major problem in the capital markets.
Good. Thanks, Joe, for that input, and Damon, thanks also for the commentary on fraud. Let's move along to the second topic, where we have issued a concept release on confirmations, and Dee Miranda Gould is going to give you a summary of the comments received there. Thanks, Dee.
Thank you, Marty. So as you're aware, we spoke with the SAG last April regarding confirmations, and we released a concept release in the middle of April. The comment period ended May 29th, and we received 24 comments. The majority of those comments, again, are from firms or associations of accountants. And then there's a smattering academics, issuers, other standard setters, other organizations, the like, in those comments. And similar to Keith's comments, I just want to go through some discussion of some key themes with those comments. Generally, commenters were supportive of the PCAOB considering revising its standard on confirmations, and that was mostly because of changes in technology that didn't exist at the time the original standard was put in place. A number of commenters, a lot of auditors, referred us to the IAASB standard, ISO 505, which deals with confirmations, and the ASB's proposed statement on auditing standards, which came out at the end of May of this year, to look to try to align with those standards and also be more principles-based in our approach, so not include a lot of additional requirements in the standard was what was recommended to us. We were also recommended to focus on risk, make the standard be based on the use of confirmations be based on an auditor's risk assessment. And then as a general comment, we received a lot of support for revising the definition of confirmation. In the concept release, we asked the question whether or not confirmation should be revised and should include direct access to information held by a third party on behalf of the confirming party. And overwhelmingly, the commenters supported us revising the definition, incorporating direct access as a confirmation. The other thing that came out of that, though, surprised us a little, was that the majority of commenters who did comment in this area also suggested that oral confirmation should not be, oral responses should not be a confirmation. Other areas we asked questions was regarding the requirement to confirm. So we asked whether or not the standard, a revised standard, should include additional presumptions to confirm certain accounts, transactions, the like. And there were divergent views on this. Auditors generally were not supportive of expanding the presumption beyond confirming accounts receivable. And a number of other groups, the academics, some of the issuers, some of the individuals, investors, supported adding additional requirements, making the requirement to confirm cover additional areas, especially risky areas, was the general comment we got there. We also asked about disclaimers and restrictive language. That's showing up in a lot more confirmation responses. And we asked if that a new standard should include something around that, requirements for the auditor to evaluate the language that's there, specific procedures. Generally, the commenters who commented here suggested that we clarify the auditor's responsibility to consider this language, and also provide perhaps some more guidance around what language creates a problem, what language doesn't create a problem. One other area we addressed was with regard to negative confirmations. We asked the question of whether or not we should keep negative confirmations as a form of confirmation and allow it in the standard. And the individuals who did respond, virtually everybody who responded on this question, suggested that we do continue to allow negative confirmations, although it was recommended that we limit when they can be used. So those are some general. There were other questions we asked in the concept release, but these were some general ones that we just wanted to highlight for you, and I'd be happy to get any input from anyone on the area of confirmations, any concerns that people think we need to consider. Paul.
And this will be very brief. It seems to me the divergent views on expanding the presumption beyond accounts receivable would be contrary to the previous slide where you say it should be risk-based. If it's risk-based, they will determine when they need to do something beyond accounts receivable. So I can't quite understand why the academics would be arguing to do more because of risk if it's already covered on the previous slide.
If I can just answer that, I think the issue there was that there are certain areas like investments certain revenue transactions and the like that individual commenters thought were riskier areas in the first place, so that the auditor should confirm those types of things because they're higher risk, and that would go along the lines of the risk focus. But I take your point. I understand the confusion there. Any other comments, thoughts? Yes.
It seems that all the themes I'm hearing today are auditors don't understand how to evaluate the risk of fraud. Auditors don't know how to evaluate when the risk is great enough that a third-party independent confirmation is required. Auditors don't understand, and we'll get later to how to evaluate fair value properly or related party transactions properly. And I guess I'm waiting for a conversation about how we're going to train auditors in these processes. And yet, all I'm hearing is, so let's just default to a standard that requires or presumes certain risk assessments, which goes against pretty much everything that I know about auditing, is that you're supposed to be capable of evaluating risk and employing your time and resource properly to these items. And I wish there was a place in all of this where we said we don't have to answer every failure by an auditor with a standard that requires a presumption that something is therefore high risk. We had to redo Audit Standard 2 because it was so prescriptive, and it had so much, if you have this, then it is a material weakness. And we backed off of that and said, for example, these are examples of what might be a material weakness, but we got rid of the always and never type of language. And so, again, I just wish there was a place in all this where students were better trained in risk assessment and audit technique and theory, and less about presumption in the standards about you have to confirm something. That ought to be left to us to decide. And if you're telling us we don't know how to decide that, then there's another failure here. But it's not necessarily always going to be resolved with or by a standard.
Can I just react to that a little bit, at least from the standpoint of risk assessment? I take your point about a large number of presumptions, certainly. I think one of the things that we tried to do with the risk assessment standards in making them in the foundational principles is to set forth a process that allows the auditor to demonstrate that they have a reasonable basis for those risk assessments, okay? And then they can develop and how they can develop responses that are commensurate with the risks. So I think that is an approach that we're trying to follow. But for purposes of standard setting and discussion, I think sometimes it's helpful to just lay out these points for discussion and say, have these risen to the point where they're important enough, often enough, that there ought to be a presumption here? It's a point of discussion. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the intention. Okay, so.
And the last comment I'd like to make is that, of course, Dee was putting up some of the responses we got back and not necessarily how we're going to deal with those responses, but that there were some mixed views with respect to the presumption, and she was just commenting on that. So we'll take those, we're taking all of those comments into consideration, and we do think that the comments certainly supported amending the standard, but we'll take the other comments into consideration as to how we do that. And again, our target on that, according to our plan, is to get a proposed standard for public comment during the first quarter.
Sam, did you want to?
If the chairman will recognize me.
Sam Ranzilla.
Well, Marty, I thought you were just trying to cut me off, so I at least wanted to give you the chance to do that formally. Fair enough. I think Liz brings up some excellent points, and we'll get to that as we go through each of the three projects, and let me say up front, my comment has nothing to do with audit confirmations. But I agree with Liz that there is a theme running through the papers later this afternoon and tomorrow to adding requirements and very prescriptive set of standards. And I think you ought to think very long and hard about going down a path that is very prescriptive. And I also warn you about the presumptive nature that you just presume something is a risk factor or is a bad thing, and therefore you go to, you know, an extended audit response to it. But you can avoid that by, you know, documenting in some level of detail why you overcame that presumption. Human behavior will just accept that it's whatever it is you presumed it was in the standard, because the risk of trying to get second-guessed by either me as an internal inspector or the external inspector, and quite frankly, it might be more efficient to actually just go do unnecessary work than it would be to document why you don't need to do unnecessary work. I just think going down a presumptive path is something that is in my mind, a very significant decision that the board will be making, and one that you should not take without a great deal of soul searching.
Good. Thanks for that input, Sam. Randy Fletcher?
Gosh, after that, I hate to go back to confirmation, Sam, but you mentioned there about disclaimers and restrictive language. You talked about that stuff at the last meeting in terms of seeing more of that and how to evaluate whether that was to such extent that you really couldn't treat it as audit evidence. I guess the other thing is also we've seen increasing instances where companies just won't respond, and whether that's kind of a misinterpretation of Section 303 of Sarbanes-Oxley or not, I guess I would make sure as you write your standard, not to deal with disclaimers and restrictions, but where you just recognize you're talking about using confirmations more often, and yet maybe respondents are not required to send them back to you. And I don't have a solution here because you're talking about public companies, non-public individuals. It's not like there's any one group that can dictate that people have to respond. But I would encourage you in the standard itself for covering releases to recognize that as you talk about it is good evidence, try to use it more often, you know, that you're going to have to deal with situations where you are unable to get a response and have to do alternative work to satisfy the evidential matter.
Thank you, Randy. As you may be aware, in the comments we've received, we certainly received a lot of suggestions that we consider response rates and we consider disclaimers and consider whether or not there's anything we can do as a group to help improve that. So it's certainly something that we haven't forgotten and we are considering in the whole process as we go down this path. Yep. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your comments on that. So the third item we have is the concept release on potentially requiring the engagement partner to sign the audit report in addition to the firm. And that comment period is closed as well, and Bella Rivshin is going to give a summary of the comments received here.
Good afternoon. The July 28th concept release is the most recent concept release the board issued to solicit public comment on whether the board should require the auditor with final responsibility for the audit to sign the audit report in addition to the currently existing requirement for the audit firm to sign its name on the audit report. As Marty mentioned before lunch, the SAG discussed this topic last year, and this is after the U.S. Department of Treasury Advisory Committee on the Audit Profession issued their final report, which included this recommendation. The board received 23 comments from auditors, investors, academics, and others. As you can tell, most of the comment letters came from accounting firms and Association of Accountants. The comment letters can be found on the board's website under the rulemaking docket number 29, in addition to the comment letters for confirmations and also risk assessment in case after this discussion you're interested in actually looking at some more specific comments. I think differently than the comments that were received on confirmations and possibly risk assessment, there were very opposing views relating to this topic. I think it's similar to the SAG discussion. There were certain individuals on one side who felt very strongly that this is a requirement that will increase audit quality and investor protection, and there were others who felt that this would not provide any additional information as it relates to investors and would not increase the quality of the audits for several reasons. The investors who commented do think that this would enhance audit quality by strengthening the auditor accountability and improving the transparency of the audit process. There were academics who commented that stated that such a requirement could have a number of positive effects. While an association of academics commented that based on the existing research, it is unclear whether the signature of the engagement partner would improve the audit quality. Auditors felt strongly that such a requirement would not increase audit quality because partners are already held accountable to their own very strong sense of professionalism and accountability, supplemented by mechanisms that are in place to allow third parties to hold them accountable. The commenters noted that such mechanisms include the firm's own system of quality control over its auditing and accounting practice, the firm's internal inspection process, the PCAOB inspection process, and the oversight by the audit client's audit committee and other regulators such as the SEC and state boards of accountancy. Accounting firms also commented that requiring an engagement partner to sign the audit report would not provide any additional benefit over and above the existing mechanisms of accountability and transparency, and in fact could result in unintended consequences. Finally, the auditors were concerned that the signature may lead to a misconception by investors that in terms of who's actually responsible for the audit and the issuance of the audit opinion, specifically, audits are accomplished because of the all the resources of the firm, which include the engagement team, the engagement quality review partner, specialty partners if certain expertise is needed, and also consultation with the national office if needed. There were opposing views, again, as it relates to the transparency and also the possibility if users would be better to, by having the signature, would be better to evaluate and predict the quality of a particular audit. Investors stated that the transparency would be useful to investors, audit committees, and audit firms because it could evaluate the extent of the engagement partner's experience and the firm's policy on developing and enhancing the engagement partner's expertise, as well as oversight of engagement partners. They could evaluate the quality, expertise, and better supervision of the audit team and the entire audit process, evaluate whether the auditor biases on information processing is reduced, and whether there's enhanced auditor's consensus and effort. Academics who commented pointed out that the engagement partner is already known to the audit committee and that the knowledge and the identity of the engagement partner may be potentially helpful to investors, but they were not aware of any research that directly addresses this issue. Auditors who commented stated that the engagement partner's name is already readily known to the board of directors, management, and regulators, and they were unclear as to how the knowledge of the name would provide useful information without understanding the specific capabilities of the actual partner. Auditors stated that it's important to recognize that the corporate governance process operating under the various federal and regulatory regimes under which investors are represented by the board of directors and in turn the audit committee, and the audit committee has the responsibility to hire, evaluate, and compensate the audit firm and therefore is in the best position to evaluate the firm and the engagement partner. Auditors also commented of how they were unclear that how the investor would be able to learn from the public disclosure of the firm partner's name, because in most cases the engagement partner would not otherwise be known to the investing public, and his and or her sole identifying characteristic would not be nothing more than that she or he is a partner at an accounting firm. They stated that it's unlikely to assist the users of audit reports to evaluate the qualifications or predict the quality of the audit because only knowing the partner's name, again, would not provide the engagement partner's expertise on a particular type of audit or his or her track record relating to that engagement and other engagements that partner is associated with. Instead, auditors stated that including the individual engagement partner signature on the audit report could create misconceptions that the single person is responsible for the effort and not the collaboration of individuals in the firm. People did mentioned that there this type of requirement could lead to some inaccuracies and conclusions about the quality of the audit under certain circumstances, because people might draw inappropriate or inaccurate conclusions about the audit based solely on the identity of the partner. People who commented on this were mainly auditors and not investors and others. The auditor stated that such a requirement could result in a creation of databases or other type of clearinghouses that would attempt to create a scorecard of the skills and qualifications of auditors, resulting in what was likely to be an incomplete and misleading information, that these types of databases could provide misleading statistical analysis based on the number of audits performed by an engagement partner, or they could level unfair criticism or create adverse publicity for an individual partner because he or she was named as an engagement partner for a controversial company or company that has gone through some financial difficulties. auditors also stated that a scorecard would not appropriately consider the partner's expertise outside of the public company audit contacts, and a potential impact of these inferences may be that the engagement partner become overly concerned with such a scorecard and therefore become reluctant to be associated with certain issuers. Auditors also stated that the conclusions drawn from such inferences may result in unintended consequences for smaller firms who may not be perceived to have as a robust scorecard as compared to partners from larger firms, which may impact their ability to compete and for audits of public companies. And finally, auditors reiterated that there are many independent dependent variables that affect any simple statistic of audit quality, only one of which is the identity of the engagement partner. The auditors did also note some other unintended consequences. As I say unintended consequences, I keep looking over to see if Lynn is over there to comment on the word. The auditors reiterated that the requirement runs counter to how the carefully cultivated culture of collaboration in the firms, that was a mouthful, and would send the wrong message to the marketplace that the opinion is the engagement partner's sole responsibility. There also, as I mentioned, could be what is called guilt by association of certain audits. If there's a partner who's repeatedly tasked with handling the most toughest of the audit engagements, the public may gain an inaccurate impression of that partner due to the perception of guilt by association with companies with financial reporting difficulties. And as a result, there could be the willingness of audit partners to serve on engagements for certain audit clients may wane. Auditors also were concerned that investors could second-guess an audit committee selection of an audit firm and the engagement partner, that the shareholders may believe that it is appropriate to contact the engagement partner directly to ask questions about the audit and the company's financial statements and other matters. This would put both the shareholders and the auditors in an uncomfortable position because a lot of the questions probably the auditor could not answer due to confidentiality requirements. Auditors mentioned that there could be harassment and personal danger to an individual audit partner, and that the heightened concerns about personal risk may cause an engagement partner to be less willing, again, to make the professional judgments imperative to the execution and timeliness and cost effectiveness of high-quality audits. And finally, auditors stated this could increase the individual liability of partners, which could result in a number of partners willing to sign audit company opinions to be lower, and a number of firms willing to undertake this type of work to be negatively impacted. Those firms in the marketplace, they stated, remaining could potentially charge higher fees to the perceived increased liability. As I stated, these were very interesting comment letters to read and very opposing views on this matter, and you're more than welcome to read them in more depth and on our rulemaking docket on our website. I'll now open up for comments to SAG members and observers. And Wayne Collins.
Yeah, mine is more of a process question. I note that of the 23 comment letters, 17 were from county firms or associations of accountants. So, you know, 6 were from non-accounting related sources. In the board's deliberation of a standard, obviously you're looking at the substantive nature of the comments that are made, but to what extent is there the way that the quantitative nature of the comments espousing a certain position?
I think it's the quality of the comments that is made versus the number of times a comment is made. If there is one person that makes a very significant, well-thought-out comment, the board will take that into consideration, even if they were the only individual who made that comment. But we always hope that many more people will comment on our standards and concept releases.
Kind of as a follow-up to what Wayne just mentioned, it seems to me that if only 2 responses represented investors, I would perceive from that there's a high level of ambivalence among the investors, and that therefore, I'm not sure if there's a reason to move forward with this. Obviously, the audit firms are probably pretty dead set against it, and if the investors don't seem to think it matters, why are we talking about it?
This is Barb Roper. Could I comment quickly on that?
Yes, Barbara.
I just think that's not an assumption that you can make from that low number of responses. I think if you looked across the issues that the board addresses, the sad fact is that there is consistently a low number of investor responses, and that it is a mistake to assume that that reflects ambivalence. I think it's as likely to reflect a lack of awareness on the part of the public about this process rather than anything definitive about what their views would be if they were more aware.
Galen Hansen.
During the Treasury Committee proceedings and the testimony, the investors felt very, very strongly about this. So maybe we only had a couple of comment letters, and that would be consistent with what Barbara had just mentioned. We've been over these arguments. I didn't hear any new arguments in the comment letters that we heard during the testimony that came before ACAP or in the discussion that we had last year, or maybe it was the last SAG meeting. On this particular issue, but we've been doing what we have for the last 100 years, and if we keep doing things the way we always have, then why would we expect a different outcome? And perhaps it might be time to try something a little bit different. But I found the comment on the idea that we're going to have a shortage of partners willing to sign audit reports particularly. I don't even know how to respond to that. I just don't see that happening. That people are going to be not willing to step up to the plate, and there'll be a shortage of partners. I don't see that happening.
Joe Carsello.
Well, I was involved with one of the comment letters, so how I feel is known. So I'll try to keep what I say brief, because there's so much that you said I could respond to. First, in response to Paul, there were only two investor groups that commented. I would point out that one of those investor groups is essentially an umbrella investor group. Jeff may want to pipe in here at some point. But that investor group controls, or the membership of that investor group has $3 trillion of assets under management. And the other investor group that commented, or other investor, has $200 billion. Of assets under management. So these are very, very significant investor groups. The second point I would make is I would encourage the board to look at the comment letters from the firms were very good. They obviously have very bright people who spend time writing very good comment letters. But in fairness to the firm people, they have a vested interest in this debate. And the two investor groups are the customer of the financial reports and of the auditor report. And the academics really have no obvious vested interest. And of the five, four of the five were unequivocally in support of this recommendation. And only one of the five was somewhat, I would say, both pro and con in that comment letter. I think the board should look at the quality of ACAP, as I talked about this morning. The membership of that group. I would point out that the United Kingdom has already implemented this. The United Kingdom has not only implemented this, they have implemented or are on the way to implementing audit quality indicators. They have firms filing financial statements. I just wrote a comment letter this weekend on independent members of firm governing boards, which they have a concept release out on, which is also part of ACAP. So it would appear to an outside party that in terms of what investors want, the United Kingdom is leading and the United States is lagging. As an American citizen, as an investor, that makes me uncomfortable. I would agree with the firms that I think in most cases this will not matter. If we were to look at the partners in this room, these are all people of high integrity and high competence, and I don't think it would make any difference on the audits they do. But I do think it could matter in the tails. I won't go into too much depth, but there have been enforcement actions by the PCAOB against some individual partners. In my opinion, somewhat egregious cases of knowing behavior And if that person had to sign his or her name, would it have been different? It's hard to prove in advance, but it certainly might. It's obvious that the firms are against this. The one argument that they made that I do agree with is I do think it's important to craft whatever you do here so as to not increase legal liability on the part of individual partners. I think there's enough legal liability, so I don't think they need more legal liability. So I think that's a fair argument. Some of their other arguments I thought were pretty weak, but I think that's a fair argument. And given the opposition by the firms, I think I have a very simple solution for you, and that is the United Kingdom has implemented this requirement in 2008. As of December 31st, 2009, you're going to have 2 years of data. Study the data. See what happens. Does mean behavior change? Does the variance change? What are the outcomes, both good and bad, of this requirement? Talk about a petri dish. Short of Canada, the United Kingdom is going to be about as close as you're going to get. And so I think that could be very informative to the board.
Thank you, Joe. Jeff Mahoney?
I think Joe just covered every point I was going to make, but maybe I have a couple more, so thank you, Joe. Just a couple to add on. One of the individuals who brought this to the attention of the committee, very prominent accountant that we all know, his name isn't a report, so I'm not going to name him, but worked for a Big Four accounting firm. I asked him if he was on the Treasury Committee, what is the number one thing that he would recommend, and this was his idea. Former Big Four partner, internationally known, very well respected. I've also had conversations offline with Big Four auditors on this point in the arguments, and I get a little bit different story than what you recited in the letters. I've heard all the arguments as part of the Treasury Committee, and I find most all of them very weak. I would also point out on the legal issue, I agree with Joe on that. The committee discussed that. We had some very prominent attorneys involved in that process. You'll see in the Treasury report that they indicated that this could be done without imposing additional liability on auditors, with language similar to language that was used for Section 407 on Audit Committee Financial Experts. That's footnote 87 in the Treasury report. Thank you.
If there aren't any other comments, we will move on to our next topic on fair value measurements and the use of specialists.
I hope you found this helpful, that we will, from time to time, as we have standards that we're proposing or concept releases that are outstanding, as we get comments, we'll try to share it with the SAG to try to keep you updated as we're moving ahead with our standard setting, and to bring that before the SAG and see if there's any further input that we can get from you in our thinking. So I found it useful, and I hope you all did as well. So as Bella mentioned, the next subject on our agenda is auditing fair value measurements and using the work of a specialist. There's probably a few subjects that have been discussed more in the past couple of years than fair value measurements. And we've been looking at our auditing standards in this area for a while. We've had some discussions on this before the SAG before. And we're moving ahead with our thinking in terms of proposing a standard on fair value measurements and the use of specialists. And we thought as we did that, this was a good time to come back to the SAG with some of the issues and topics we're facing as we're moving forward. Greg Fletcher, Associate Chief Auditor, is going to share with us some highlights of what we're going to be talking about for about the next 30 minutes or so, and then we'll take a break, and then SAG members and observers will move to breakout sessions. Greg?
Hey, thanks, Marty. Well, in this session, we'll discuss the potential direction of some standard-setting projects on auditing fair value and using the work of a specialist. I'd like to provide an overview of the topics to be discussed and that they're highlighted in this slide right here, discussion topics. And as Marty said, at the end of this, we'll break into groups and discuss these in more detail. The objective of this session is to try to answer any questions you all might have about the briefing paper or what our objectives were, so feel free to interrupt me with any questions as we go along. I built some time into this presentation. So first, let's discuss identifying and assessing risks of material misstatement. In general, auditors respond to assess risk of material misstatement by performing audit procedures in response to risk. The PCAOB standard on fraud requires the auditor to evaluate whether identified risks of material misstatement due to fraud are related to specific financial statement accounts. The standard notes that certain accounts, classes of transactions, and assertions have high inherent risk because they involve a high degree of management judgment and subjectivity. And they also may present risks of material misstatement because they are susceptible to manipulation by management. The standard notes as an example that assets resulting from investing activities may be deemed to have a high inherent risk because of the subjectivity and management judgment involved in estimating the fair values. And collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities come to mind as examples of such assets. Revenue recognition is an area where the fraud standard requires the auditor to ordinarily presume that there is a risk of material misstatement due to fraud. The staff believes that fair value, that for certain fair value measurements, there might also be a presumed risk of material misstatement due to fraud. In particular, fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty could be presumed to represent a risk of material misstatement. Examples of indicators that might help an auditor evaluate whether there is a high degree of measurement uncertainty are on page 8 of the briefing paper. For example, an indicator could be that there is a wide range of potential valuations based on the sensitivity of the estimate. In other words, a small change in an assumption could result in a significant change in the valuation. And this would be a situation where an assumption is very sensitive to small changes. A presumption does not mean that there is a fraud. However, the auditor's response to the assessment of risks due to fraud involve the application of professional skepticism in gathering and evaluating audit evidence. The fraud standard also includes general guidance involving the nature, timing, and extent of procedures to address fraud risk. For example, for revenue recognition, an example of a response is confirming with customers relevant contract terms and the absence of side agreements because the appropriate accounting often is influenced by such terms or agreements. A fraud risk presumption for fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty might be appropriate because they may have high inherent risk and a high amount of management judgment and subjectivity. For example, related to subjectivity, in estimating the fair value of a financial statement asset in a market that is not active, the use of a reporting entity's own assumptions about future cash flows and appropriately risk-adjusted discount rates is acceptable when relevant observable inputs are not available. This means that an entity can use its own assumptions when observable inputs are not available. An entity's own assumptions could be very subjective. So in the breakout sessions, three questions will be discussed related to a fraud risk presumption for fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty. The first question is, should there be a requirement for the auditor to presume that a fair value measurement with a high degree of measurement uncertainty is a fraud risk? And then the follow-on question to that is, would such a requirement enhance the auditor's ability to identify the types of material misstatements that could occur? The second question is, would a requirement for the auditor to perform specific procedures similar to those contained in the fraud standard concerning revenue recognition, like I just mentioned, confirmations, in response to the risk of fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty, would that improve the auditor's ability to identify the types of material misstatements that could occur? And the last question is, would consideration of the factors in the briefing paper assist the auditor in evaluating which accounting measurements have a high degree of measurement uncertainty? So I'll pause right there just to see if anybody has any questions about the first topic, the fraud risk presumption. Okay. Okay, Damon Silvers?
I mean, do we know anything, or can you tell us anything about what inspections tell us in relation to the, I gather, the staff's concerns about these issues?
I don't think we can
say too much more than what was put out in a 4010 report in terms of with some commentary on this issue that fair value in many cases fair values, especially fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty, in some cases, you know, the auditors and audits inspected failed to show the professional skepticism that one would expect for those circumstances. So what that would lead us to conclude is, well, if we raise the bar, if you would, that said that fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty were perceived to be potentially risks of material misstatement for fraud, that would at least raise the bar in terms of the audit procedures and focus that would have to be placed on that. So that's what informs this topic.
Thank you.
The next section of the briefing paper is on evaluating the adequacy of fair value disclosures. Fair value disclosures have become increasingly important for investors in determining and understanding a company's financial position and operating results. Recently issued accounting standards of the Financial Accounting Standards Board and the International Accounting Standards Board include disclosure requirements to provide users with more qualitative information about the nature of a company's objectives, assumptions, and methods associated with fair value. For example, FASB codification topic 820 on fair value states that, quote, the reporting entity shall disclose information that enables users to assess, close quote, for recurring fair value measurements, the inputs used to develop those fair value measurements, and for recurring fair value measurements using significant unobservable inputs, the effect of the measurement on earnings for the period. Now, this example and others are on start on page 10 of the briefing paper. In addition, the FASB proposed an amendment to the fair value standards in August that would require an entity to disclose, quote, the total effects of changes in reasonably possible alternative inputs, close quote. The FASB stated in the exposure draft that for fair value measurements using significant unobservable inputs, if changing one or more of those inputs to reasonably possible alternative inputs would increase or decrease the fair value measurement significantly, sometimes referred to as sensitivity disclosures, the reporting entity would state that fact and disclose the total effects of the changes on the fair value measurements. And this was proposed in August. I'm not sure how far along the FASB is in their thinking on this, whether or not they still believe this. So I wonder if Peter might be able to share some information on that.
Sure, Greg. The comment period ended October 12th, just a couple of days ago. And I checked at midday, and there were just over 100 comments posted to our website. I'm sure there's additional comments that are in the pipeline that haven't been posted. So the staff is busy going through all those comments, and that will take a little time, although we've been through a chunk of them already. The staff will be analyzing those comments, and among the alternatives that we've been talking about, And again, I caution, this is the staff. We've not talked to the board about this. The staff is, you know, obviously we could go ahead with the sensitivity disclosure. We're calling it more of a range of possible fair values now rather than sensitivity. Or we could go ahead with that requirement but provide some scope outs. For example, private companies. Some of the comment letters we have read indicate a different need for investors or lenders in private companies. Possible additional scope outs that we're talking about include scoping out some non-financial assets and liabilities, goodwill and assets and liabilities that arise in a business combination. We're also talking about an option that would not prescribe quantitative ranges of possible fair values, but more emphasis on describing and providing some data around the inputs and the methodology, beefing up that requirement. There's also a school of thought that says, in light of IFRS 7 being in full effect at the end of 2009, maybe we should step back and use application of that standard as the Petri dish, as an expanded field test. We did a field test as part of the exposure draft, but you know, one avenue we might consider is delaying, in effect, to get the benefit of what the ISB has done.
Okay, Thanks a lot, Peter. Appreciate that. Although not necessarily related to fair value, FASB Statement 166, Accounting for Transfers of Financial Assets, includes a plain English principles-based disclosure requirement. That standard provides that the disclosure shall be presented in a manner that clearly and fully explains to financial statement users the transferor's risk exposure related to the transferred financial assets and any restrictions on the assets of the entity. And here's the plain English principles-based disclosure requirement. The entity must strike a balance between obscuring important information as a result of too much aggregation and excessive detail that may not assist financial statement users to understand the entity's financial position. For example, an entity shall not obscure important information by including it with a large amount of insignificant detail. Similarly, an entity shall not disclose information that is so aggregated that it obscures important differences between the different types of involvement or associated risks. So this requirement seems to indicate that an entity should not obscure important information through notes that are too detailed or too aggregated. Based on this accounting requirement, it seems like the auditor should evaluate whether a company's notes are obscuring important information through, one, too much aggregation, or two, obscuring important information by including a large amount of insignificant detail. Now, the fair value auditing standard contains fairly strong requirements for evaluating whether fair value disclosures are in conformity with the applicable accounting requirements, but that standard was written almost 10 years ago. One of the strong parts of the standard is that when auditing fair value measurements and related disclosures, the auditor ordinarily performs essentially the same types of audit procedures as those employed in auditing a fair value measurement recognized in the financial statements. And what that means is that the level of effort for auditing the footnotes should be the same as auditing the financial statements. As good as these requirements are, they may need to be enhanced to enable the auditor to sufficiently evaluate the qualitative and other accounting disclosure requirements. If the fair value amendment were to go through as proposed, for example, the auditor would be required to evaluate whether a disclosed alternative input is, one, reasonable, and two, reasonably possible. In addition, this accounting disclosure requirement seems to indicate a more active response to evaluating disclosures. This seems to require what is known as an understatement test. In other words, are there reasonably possible alternative inputs that a company did not consider? In addition, all these accounting disclosures seem to indicate the auditor should evaluate the understandability of disclosures. So based on all this discussion, we're asking the great breakout groups to discuss one question, basically. Given the movement towards more qualitative disclosures about assets and liabilities measured at fair value and the related risks and disclosures about sensitivity of certain assumptions, is there a need for additional requirements for evaluating the adequacy of disclosures? And again, I'll pause here to see if there's any questions. Okay. Well, the last section is on using the work of a specialist. Lynn Turner.
Greg, I got a question for you. As part of the inspection process, have, as the board or the members of the staff, looked at the number of hours that people spend on auditing the footnotes, where there is a significant amount of information that investors use and some very important information? That's why it goes in the footnotes. And, of course, these footnotes have gotten longer as businesses got into a lot more activities and a lot more complexity. But have you looked at the hours? And if so, what percentage of those hours are versus auditing the numbers in the financial statements? Because my guess would be that if you looked at it, there are very few and a very insignificant portion of the hours actually spent on auditing the footnotes. And if that were the case, then that would tell me that, yeah, you probably got something that you need to do with the standard.
To my knowledge, I don't think the inspectors are capturing that information when they do their inspections. Check around the room.
Yeah, I don't know if they are or not, but we don't have that information available today. It's a good question, and we'll take a look into it, but we don't have that information available today.
Lynn Coleman?
I was just going to say, if you're going to look into it, I think that you need to think about it broadly, because Lynn, I think when you do that, you got to think in terms of organizations have systems, processes, and other things that are looked at as part of an integrated audit, and then you have outputs, right? So I think you just need to be careful in any analysis that you do, you know, what conclusions you draw.
Jeff Mahoney?
Thanks, Greg. Just a couple general comments. So first, I would note that the challenges that auditors face in auditing fair value measurements that have a high degree of measurement uncertainty, as described in the memo, do not appear to be entirely new or unique challenges for the auditing profession. For example, auditors have, since 1992, have been required to audit fair value measurements for all financial instruments, including many that don't have readily available market prices. Also point, I see Jim Croker's gone, but in Jim's SEC report, December of 2008, in a study on mark-to-market accounting, all 200-some pages of it, he pointed out in that report that challenges presented by auditing fair value measurements are very similar to the challenges that auditors have long faced in connection with auditing impairments, loan loss reserves, and even depreciation expense in estimating the lives of depreciable assets. That said, to the extent that there's information from the inspection process or otherwise that indicates that the audits of fair value measurements are deficient in some manner, and that deficiency can be addressed through improving the auditing standards, I'd fully support that effort, since I believe the information that results from fair value measurements, together with robust disclosures in the area of financial instruments, provides investors far more accurate, timely, and comparable information across different firms and positions than information that results from using the main alternative, which is the amortized cost approach. The Council issued a white paper in July of last year, available on our website, www.cii.org, entitled Understanding Issues Raised by the Credit Crunch, which was prepared by Stephen Ryan of Stern School of Business at NYU, that goes through in quite a bit of detail on contrasting fair value measurements to amortized cost measurements for financial instruments and describes the differences, with the conclusion that with respect to financial instruments, fair value measurements with robust disclosures provide investors far more useful information. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Greg Jonas?
Question. It's clear to me how auditors go about considering errors in the basic financial statements with formal policies of how those errors are posted to schedules, aggregated, and then looked at individually and in total. It's less clear to me how practice is looking at errors, discovered errors in footnotes. Do you have any inspection intelligence that of how the firms are looking at those errors, and do you have any concerns with what you found?
I think that's another area where we don't have any data, but we can certainly look into that. Sam Ranzilla? Or wait a minute, I'm sorry. Damon Silvers.
Sam, are you commenting on Greg's point?
I was going to try to at least give you one firm's perspective. When we accumulate audit differences or differences relative to the financial statements, we actually have a category called disclosures, and all the disclosures that we think are either missing or inappropriate are cataloged in there, and the engagement partner, along with the engagement quality reviewer and others, if consultation is necessary, will look at those matters within the context of the financial statements taken as a whole and conclude whether or not we need to modify our auditor's report absent some action taken by the preparer.
Damon Silvers?
I think, as many of you know, I'm a pretty profound skeptic about the idea of fair value as a universal financial accounting paradigm. I've always felt, however, that fair value is an appropriate way of valuing types of assets that have the, in circumstances that are most appropriate to it, meaning financial instruments with liquid markets held in contexts where they're likely to be traded. The experience of the last 2 years has convinced me that the situation of the application of fair value to financial institutions in our economy today is one in which we say that we are doing fair value and in fact are not. And that's probably the worst possible thing to do. There are, I think, powerful arguments that financial institutions, particularly depository institutions with assets, with liabilities that can be called at any time, which on the other hand hold, you know, relatively liquid financial instruments on their balance sheet as the assets with which to meet those liabilities, that is the paradigm of the sort of circumstance where fair value is most appropriate. And that we've clearly, basically, through interpretations of FAS 157, we are not doing fair value in those circumstances. And that, in a way, the analogy that was drawn a few moments ago to impairment is a little off, meaning that in a historical cost accounting world, you kind of had very broad, you sort of had a paradigm where at some point you had to acknowledge that the asset wasn't worth what you had booked it at and what you were amortizing it at. In a fair value world, you can move the numbers around, right, without having to make a sort of major acknowledgement of that kind. And for those reasons, I think that the type of world we have built, I think in large part mistakenly, is a world where the board really must do the sort of exercise that the board is contemplating here. I don't think, however, that I think we shouldn't kid ourselves. If the rules continue to be this kind of pretend regime in which we pretend that we are valuing assets according to market prices, and in fact we are not. Instead we are basically saying the asset is worth whatever you think it's worth, whatever you say it's worth, because that's the most convenient answer. Because in fact nobody wishes to face what would happen if you actually did a hard mark on these assets. Right? As long as the entire model of our financial system is let's pretend, it's not clear to me that the board it's not clear to me that you are positioned to fix that. But that doesn't mean it's not a good thing to try. The point of my comment is to commend you for doing this. It's absolutely necessary, but I'm not terribly optimistic it will be successful.
Damon, I just have one follow-on question. Is your commentary based upon some of the same reports that you mentioned earlier that you referred to us?
Yes. Okay, yes, it is. And it's also based on something else, which is the rather astounding fact that on one and the same time, you see our largest financial institutions crowing to the world that they are recording record profits and that they're healthy and that everything is fine. And then the people who know the most about them, right, who have inside access to their financials in a way that no public investor does, right, their bank regulators, the bank regulators, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury Department won't let those same institutions return TARP money because clearly they view them as too weak.
Thank you.
I think in the interest of time, Joe, you're back up again. Okay, Joe Carcello.
My comment's not as interesting as Damon's. I have a question for Sam, though. Sam, I appreciate you sharing how you evaluate issues with disclosure, and I might have misunderstood you. But my read of Staff Accounting Bulletin 99 is that if there is essentially an intentional error in the financial statement numbers, virtually automatically it's material. Because why would management have made the error intentionally if it didn't matter? So if you come across a disclosure that's missing, not necessarily one where you would prefer different wording, but a disclosure that's missing, Why wouldn't you view that as an intentional error and require correction?
Well, I think, again, you make a presumption that if somebody missed a disclosure, they're immediately in fraudulent financial reporting. It's a little of a long stretch for me to make, Joe. I'm sorry. If I have other reasons after I investigate why a disclosure is missing, so, for example, if a preparer left out a, on a 70 row column, left out, missed one column, I don't immediately go into fraudulent accounting, fraudulent auditing, pull out SAB 99 and engage, an outside party to do an investigation. I usually try to get more facts.
But wouldn't you make them fix it if it was an honest mistake?
Is it material to the financial statements taken as a whole?
Okay.
I was just going to echo what Sam said, which was the first thing he has to do is determine whether the disclosure was material to the financial statements as a whole. And there are a lot of clients that would intentionally exclude disclosures that are not material to the financial statements. That doesn't mean it's a fraud. And that would not be evaluated in the context of the fraud standards.
They would intentionally exclude them because what?
They would say it's not material. It's not meaningful to the investor. I mean, there are a lot of disclosures that are required, but every accounting standard says you have to apply it in the context of whether it's material or not.
Of course.
Okay.
I'm not sure if Lynn or Larry are responding to Jim. Okay, Larry.
Yeah, I was just going to give that example of we do intentionally use summarized disclosure on our defined benefit pension plan disclosures because we traditionally did not have a defined benefit pension plan. We inherited it in an acquisition. The plan is frozen. We give information that we think is relevant about that plan in terms of its funded status, et cetera, but the disclosure requirements got so extensive in pension plans that we make a conscious decision about trying to make our financial statements informative and readable to a user community that's interested in certain aspects of them. And actually, we've had these discussions with the SEC staff in their review of our filings, and it's very common that we struggle with the detailed, disclosure requirements that keep on getting seemingly get added on over and over again in terms of if you followed and literally tried to deal with every one of them, your financial statements would become unwieldy. So, we've interpreted the materiality box to give us exactly that leeway to say what is most important to an investor, and you make your decisions about what's material, what's not material. So, it's not like we're trying to do fraudulent or hide anything. We're trying to make it more usable to the user community.
Okay, thank you, Larry. Lynn Turner?
First of all, two points. Back to the conundrum that Damon talked about. I think he does raise an interesting point with the fair value being where it is and where it's gone over the last 2 years, to some extent, especially since April, it does seem that what Damon has said is true. There's a real question now as to whether or not you're getting fair value on some of the data that we're seeing coming out in more recent months since the changes in April seem to indicate that it is almost pick a number, any number, rather than getting to real fair value. And in that environment, I too applaud you for trying to do something, but what you can do, I think, is questionable, because if the basic accounting standard doesn't get you there, auditing it probably isn't going to get you there either. It's going to be a real problem. On the second point, on the footnotes and the missing footnotes, to me, as an institutional investor, I'd be very concerned if an investor intentionally left out material information to the investor, I would put that in the fraud category without a doubt. What Sam and Jim tee up is a valid point. If it's a nickel and dime type number, people aren't going to particularly care about it, but it does raise the same question Jonas did, and that is, how are you guys assessing what would be considered to be material information to investors? And do you ever reach out to investors and ask them whether something would be significant or not, especially if it's in borderline type cases? And how do you go about making that assessment today, and what communication is there with investors to assess whether a disclosure, especially in borderline cases, would be material or not? Are you making that judgment in a vacuum with yourself and management and not with investors?
Jim Schnur? Lynn, I think to respond to your question, a lot of times when we assess whether something's material to the financial statements, we look at the information that analysts are putting in their reports as to what they think is important for purposes of analyzing the company. I can't say that we do that in every particular case, but we do it quite frequently, is to look at what the analysts are saying about the metrics of the company that drive the business, and therefore what's important to their analysis of the company.
Yeah, Greg, can you try to wrap up this discussion so we can move to break, and thank everybody for those input.
Okay, yeah, the next topic is the use of the work of a using the work of a specialist. Our specialist standard defines a specialist as a person or a firm possessing special skill or knowledge in an area other than accounting or auditing, and it can include actuaries, appraisers, engineers, environmental consultants, and geologists, and it also includes valuation experts. The specialist standard applies to specialists that are engaged by the auditor, which for the purpose of this briefing paper we're referring to them as outside specialists. However, for a specialist employed by the auditor, which we're calling employee specialists, the standard on planning and supervision applies to those types of specialists. Now, an employee specialist and an outside specialist are often used for the same purpose, which is to use a specialist's work as evidence in the audit. For example, the auditor could use an outside specialist or an employee specialist for evaluating the reasonableness of assumptions and methods in a fair value measurement. However, the specialist standard and the supervision standard have different requirements for the specialist. So essentially our question is should the same requirements apply for using an outside specialist and an employee specialist? In terms of evaluating the work of a specialist, our specialist standard, which applies to the outside specialist, has some requirements. Number one, obtain an understanding of the methods and assumptions used by the specialist. Number two, make appropriate tests of data provided to the specialist. And three, evaluate whether the specialist's findings support the related assertions in the financial statements. Regarding these requirements for evaluating the work of the specialist, the staff believes that the requirements could be improved. There continue to be inspection findings related to the use of specialists, and these findings could be related to the fact that it might not be completely clear what is meant by obtain an understanding of the methods and assumptions of the specialist. By contrast, the fair value auditing standard has a pretty clear requirement that requires the auditor to evaluate the reasonableness of assumptions. Other standard setters have issued standards on using the work of an outside specialist, an employee specialist. For example, the IAASB issued a standard using the work of an auditor's expert. So the staff believes that a proposed standard could enhance the requirements for the auditor's evaluation of the work of the specialist and provide additional direction beyond that which is in the specialist standard. So our last question is, What additional direction should the standard provide when evaluating the work of a specialist engaged by the auditor, given that the auditor engages a specialist since he or she does not have the requisite specialized knowledge or skills?
Okay. I think we're running a little bit late going through this, but I think it was worthwhile to get a robust discussion here about some of the issues with the group at large. Our plan now is to break and then to be in the breakout rooms. Let's try to get there at about 5 minutes after three, five or 10 minutes after three. And the break, those were handed out to everybody, right, Bella?
And they're on the breakout room assignments were emailed to the SAG members and observers. They're up on the slides, and there's also on the left-hand side in your folder, you have copies of that. There will be individuals outside helping you get to the breakout sessions. They are actually in the same rooms where you had lunch today, and so hopefully you're familiar with that room. If you can pick up all of your belongings when you're moving into that room to make sure you don't forget anything. For those individuals, because the breakout sessions are closed to the public, a summary will be provided tomorrow at 8:30 as to what happened in the different breakout sessions. And also, we're going to be having actually new copies of the fair value measurements and use of a specialist briefing paper available to you in the breakout sessions, and then at the registration table, the ones that were handed out earlier today seem to be missing the even pages, and we thought that, you know, instead of having you guys try to figure out what was said on the other pages you didn't have, we would try not to stump you in the late afternoon. But feel free to get something to drink, something to eat, to re-energize yourself, and we'll, for the SAG members and observers, get into the breakout sessions about 10 after 3. Thank you very much. Marty, anything else?
That's it. Look forward to seeing you all at the breakouts.